Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wheeler Centre for this very special afternoon event. It is good to see so many people are not gainfully employable in this country. That is deeply reassuring to see. Can't believe we've got a problem. My name is Michael Williams, and I'm director of the Wheeler Centre, and very thrilled to be introducing today's guest, who needs very little introduction. He is one of this country's finest writers. I do like that amongst the praise for his previous book, American Journeys, he's compared to a whole lot of people, and I'm going to just rattle through the list because it's a fairly imposing list. Mark Twain, Jonathan Rabin, Jack Kerouac, Andrew Ferguson, Theroux, all of them, they don't hold a candle to our guest today. Many of them are dead because they couldn't hack it when he came along. Don Watson's books include the bestsellers Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, Death Sentence, Watson's Dictionary of Weasel Words, and American Journeys. He's won the Age Book of the Year twice, a Walkley Award for Non-Fiction, the Courier Mail Book of the Year, and many other awards. He lives in the Macedon Ranges here in Victoria, and he's written a new work, which is a milestone of memoir, travel writing, and history. It's called The Bush. Please welcome Don Watson.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, Jack Kerouac couldn't handle it. Where were we up to? I have to ask you this question. How many of you are farmers? So about three, four. So all the rest of you are bludgers, right? Parasitic pavement dwellers. Mollycoddled. Never worked up a sweat except on a bicycle. Or a gymnasium. If farmers went to a gymnasium, you'd all be starving. Latte drinkers, I don't know where your latte comes from. Farmers are not all like that, I discovered writing this book. They were a bit like that when I was growing up among them. Some of them are still a bit like that. There's a certain amount of passive aggression in the bush. You're a bit careful before you knock on a door, if the dog hasn't got you before then. Now, it's curious, this passive aggression. I mean, it's not confined to farmers, of course, but you do see it. I've been doing this, sort of selling this book around a few regional places, and when you see them in their sort of lumpy jumpers with big hands and the rest, you do treat them with respect, rather like you'd treat a Kelpie dog chained up at the back door. You're a bit careful. But no one's attacked me yet at all, not except on the internet and one or two other places. I understand them, I think. But I keep saying them when I haven't never met two farmers who were the same. This is the odd thing. And I don't know quite how to explain it. I mean, I don't know why we have made the bush this place when, in fact, it is so many places, why we've chosen it as a... we've turned it into a kind of the seat of our consciousness somehow without really knowing what it is. This is one of the great unexplained mysteries of Australian life, in a way. We've been among the most urbanised countries on Earth for more than a century, and yet the bush has never really faded from our consciousness. Even as we've destroyed it or turned away from or never noticed that it was being destroyed, we've gone on singing its praises. And we don't know, we know very little about it. Even the scientists I spoke to said we know, our scientific understanding of it is considerably less than the scientific understanding of comparable places. less than 50% of all species have been properly classified in Australia. We would profess our love for it. Our politicians are forever calling on it as the sort of repository of our core values, as it were. If we drew up a mission statement for Australia, it would be there in no time at all, probably be number one, or a vision statement, and yet we have no vision for the bush at all. If you recall when John Howard called on the services of our greatest poet to do a sort of rewrite of the national vision, the first thing that was went into that was this business about mateship, practical mateship, John Howard called it, without really explaining what impractical mateship might be. In fact, it's always seemed to me that mateship is by its nature largely impractical. It's certainly not very practical for 50% of the population, unless it's practical to have them off together somewhere and out of the house. It is a strange thing about us. When I was working in the Prime Minister's office about 78 years ago, there was a... you might remember the Prime Minister of that time raised the question of changing the national flag. He didn't like the Union Jack on it, and this created a paroxysm right across the country and caused the opposition in Parliament to put little bits of bunting with the Australian flag on all their chairs. It was very, you know, gay and colourful. Anyway, what the one good thing this did, apart from some people said distracting attention from the state of the economy, was to encourage teachers to ask their students, primary school mainly, to draw Australian flags as a way to encourage them, encourage thought about where they lived. And they sent a lot of them to the Prime Minister's office, hundreds of them. We were inundated. And about 90% of them were gum trees, or Ayers Rock with a gum tree, or a sheep under a gum tree. There wasn't a single one that I recall that of a building, maybe a corrugated iron tank or something like that, an old lavatory. One of them had Bob Hawke in a gum tree, and and one had him on Ayers Rock. And we put those up most prominently so his nemesis couldn't avoid them. And just to remind him about what charisma really was. And it was... we actually spoke to the vexillologists. Some of you may not know what a vexillologist is. We didn't until then either, but they're people who care about flags and study flags. Anyway, and there is an Australian Association of Vexillologists. And they said this has always been the case. When Australians draw flags, they draw, despite the fact that we have the Southern Cross on ours and the Union Jack, any new flag is bound to be to illustrate the landscape. That's how we think of the place. Even though 90% of us cling to the shores, and a very large proportion of that 90% live in modern cities. Les Murray writes about the vernacular Australians living in the bush, you know, in his in a quite a famous essay, a very powerful essay, but I'm not sure it's entirely true. It needn't be to be a powerful essay. So how you explain this, I don't know. How you define it, scientists will tell you, and if you begin to, they tell you that, you can't drive through the Australian bush without thinking like this, that it changes every 15 kilometres or so in any direction as the soil changes. So there's a strange effect where you can drive all day and think, well, it was the same from beginning to end, but in fact you pass through a whole lot of different kinds of vegetation. We don't know, as I said, much about it. I think you could, in some ways, it's sort of explained by, as a metaphor maybe, I could use the example of a kangaroo. Where I lived until very recently, and there was a mistake in the introduction, I've actually just moved from the Macedon Ranges back into, on the pavements of Carlton and Fitzroy. But every night for several years, I'd pass this mob of kangaroos, and they always seemed to be in some different attitude. The does, if you look at them from one angle, they'll be standing there looking... Well, they used to stand under this clothesline, a rotary, a hill's hoist, a little way into a paddock. And the female kangaroos would stand there and really look as if they'd hung the washing on it. They have this sort of, here I am with my washing. And the males, of course, look like great gym bunnies, you know, sort of enormous brutes. Sometimes, but they'll also lie like, you know, old Bloomsbury bohemians, you know, they lie like this on the ground, spread out like they're the original picnickers. And then they look like dinosaurs when their backs are arched in the long grass and their heads are down. They're extraordinary creatures and different from every angle, much like the bush. When you... I started this not knowing... I did not know where to start with this bush thing, and I wondered why I'd said I'd attempt it for a very long while. But that's not a creative way to approach things, wondering why you're approaching it at all. So I started with what I thought I knew. That is something about my childhood, which of course is the least reliable place to start in one's memory. But I tried to pin it down by thinking, well, what did I... rather like closing your eyes and thinking. And what I thought about the bush was that it was work. What I saw from my childhood was men and women working. That is, and there was a sort of ballet to it. It seemed to be the drama of the bush and the substance of the bush, that there was always someone around the house sweeping or doing something. No one ever stopped, it seemed. So I decided that I would have to get a bit autobiographical, which I was reluctant because I've always thought, well, that can be the last one. When I'm in the nursing home, I can dictate it with a rug over my knees. But anyway, I've blown that chance completely, because it is more autobiographical than anything I've ever tried before, and it seemed to be the only way to make progress. So I thought of these people, particularly my father, cutting bracken and moving across the hillsides in a remarkably graceful sort of way. And I thought of my grandmother sweeping the back veranda, which she did. There's no question that she did. I've checked with my mother. It's not a false memory. She just swept furiously every day, all the way down the path, down the steps, down the path, all the way through the raspberry bushes, all the way to the dark, forbidding lavatory that sat at the end of it. And as if gum leaves that were blowing onto the veranda were nature trying to come back, and they mustn't be allowed back. And that was the second stage in this sort of thought process, that the work was mainly to do with keeping nature out. What you were really doing was, in the great Puritan tradition of making the country clean and making yourself clean by this clearing. Everything was about, you know, bracken, weeds were rubbish. And the worst thing you could do was allow your farm to go back to rubbish. Of course, a lot of the rubbish was actually native plants that had a perfect right to be there. They'd been there for a few million years before we decided to hack at them. But this contest with nature was really at the heart of farming experience then. Now, I was reading recently a book about China's great leap forward under the sage leadership of Mao Zedong, with whom some of my contemporaries were infatuated in the 1960s. The great leap forward in a matter of 4 years killed 45 million people. It didn't happen here. But Mao said at the beginning of it, we must turn our fire on nature. That is, we've been turning it on reactionaries, on the forces of Chiang Kai-shek or whoever got in their way for so long. Now we're going to turn it on nature, and they set to with a will. As a consequence, they starved 45 million people or beat them to death or whatever. But they also thoroughly ravaged the landscape of China. I mean, the destruction is truly mind-boggling. Now, it's a big leap to go from such a murderous regime to what was happening in Australia at the time. It's a matter of degree rather than a matter of intent, because what Mao said about turning our fire on nature would apply perfectly well to the first selectors in South Gippsland, where I came from, or pretty well anywhere across the continent. And it's gone on ever since. And anything that has got in our way, as we've perceived it to be in our way, we've taken out. That's not an exaggeration. And that's included the human beings who are in the way. It's certainly included the trees. 92% of old growth forest has been removed from the continent, which is a phenomenal figure. And it, of course, it includes all the, if you like, the lesser vegetation and all the creatures that have lived in it, often to the point of extinction. So while this is in some ways a hymn to the bush, it's worth thinking about what a hymn is, I suppose. I mean, we sang a lot of hymns as children. Well, we moved our mouths, at least. Our elders sang them. And they did sing them. In fact, attendance at the Presbyterian Church is what confirmed me, not in not believing that there was an afterlife, but hoping that I didn't get there. It struck me when I was about eight and sitting in the car outside the Presbyterian Ladies Guild meeting in Puong that if this was eternity, I didn't want to be in it. My move to more thoroughgoing atheism came much later, and with a great deal more regret. But anyway, when we sing a hymn, we actually sing, you know, if we sing praise him, praise him, praise the Lord, the King, we're singing partly to praise him and partly because we want to believe he's there. It's partly to drive out doubt. So I wonder if in our alleged devotion to the bush and our hymns of praise and the refusal of our politicians to brook for a moment any doubts about the bush, we're actually singing to drive out the doubts, to keep the doubts at bay. I mean, that's one of the... That is, after all, what a hymn does. It's partly to praise or to assert something, and it's partly to keep doubt away. We believe, we believe, we believe. So I think the bush legend or myth needs to be... It's quite a useful thing for the country to unpick the bush legend and see what it is, what doubts we have that we're concerned about. And that's, in a way, what I tried to do here. Criticise how we've managed the natural environment of this country, although I do. But not only that, but I mean, I think because it's just a worthwhile process. And what's odd about a legend, of course, is those who resist it. The cliche mongers of our national life are averse to self-knowledge. It's funny how you can actually talk to farmers and say, isn't self-knowledge a good thing? You know, knowing about what actually happened, what's so frightening about it? And generally, if you approach it at the right angle, they'll agree that it is. But we're up against it. I mean, I think you could make... I haven't done it here, and I won't do it today, but you can make a very strong case to say that it's keeping us stupid, this bush thing. It's baffling us. It's making it too easy to not take a serious interest in a whole lot of things. I mean, if for instance, not to be political, of course, but to look at... If you look at the last budget, I mean... Why would you be cutting into the CSIRO now? It's very hard to understand. Why would you be slashing a research budget? This is entirely consistent with the problem that's been there all along, that we've simply failed to understand, or we've just rejected a scientific approach to farming, to how we handle the bush, to even to understanding it. I tried to define what the bush is at one point, and I was conscious that in the way I defined it, I was also saying that it was it defies definition. I should point out also that the bush was not the bush. Where I grew up, the last thing anyone dared say to us that we were living in the bush. The bush was a primitive state from which we'd emerged. And we weren't going back. That was the whole point of the labour, to keep things clean, to have a clean farm. But it's only recently that anybody who lives outside the outer suburbs lives in the bush. Very odd the way these things happen. The Australian bush is both real and imaginary, real in that it grows in various unmistakable bush-like ways, and dies, rots, burns, and grows into the bush again, real in harbouring life. Imaginary in that among the life it harbours is the life of the Australian mind. It is, by many accounts, the source of the nation's idea of itself. The bush is everything from a gum tree to any of the creatures that live in it or shelter beneath it, and it is the womb and inspiration of the national character. It's the smell of eucalyptus leaves, long shards of bark waiting for a fire, the din of galahs, the cawing of crows, and invincible silence. It is the blue horizon, the ute trailing a cloud of dust, the silo, the sale yard, the drover's wife. It's an uneducated cow cocky and a private school laird with a law degree. It's each dawn heralded by the insane laughter of a kookaburra or the warble of a magpie and the inspiration for literature, philosophy and art, and also, some will declare, an impediment to all of those. The bush is a social construct as well as an ecological one. As much as the things that grow and live there, we define it by the people who inhabit it. Now, I get going again on the same sort of theme later on, and it might be worth mentioning because this becomes a sort of theme of the book. The bush is the twitter and tinkle of wrens and fantails and the sound of a truckload of calves on the way to oblivion. It has equal measures of what was there before Europeans came and what is there now. It is what we have done to the natural environment and what it has done to us, the world outside us and the world within. Wilderness, home and garden, temple, nursery and slaughterhouse. And this is the thing, when you begin to unpick it sometimes by looking at diaries which haven't been much looked at, sometimes by talking to people who live in the bush, sometimes by calling on one's own experience, but also by seeing what is in plain sight in well-known books that have become famous for things other than that which they contain. For instance, if you want to, given that we went back into denial about 1996 about what happened on the frontier of Australia, what happened to Indigenous Australians, it's interesting to see that it's really not the revisionist historians, the so-called black armband historians, who made the case for the slaughter that occurred on the frontier. It was actually made by writers widely read in Australia, like Ernestine Hill or Nancy Jurak. It's all there. They both write about it openly, and this was read by hundreds of thousands of people. So it's not invented by a bunch of bleeding hearts from the city. It's actually there for all to see, and it's confirmed in the diaries. The real horror of it is confirmed in diaries. I thought I knew about it until I started reading these things, and I found myself very strongly agreeing with James Boyce, the Tasmanian historian, that we don't know the half of it. It's actually much worse than the worst of the black armbandists said. Anyway, it's there in the book, but I'd like to think it's there more as a theme, which is to say that we ought to know these things. One of the things that Jurak says several times, and it's said all through the literature, is that there was this terrible silence about it all. You know, the Americans, once Hollywood got going, made heroes of Indian killers like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and Kit Carson and so on. We always hid it. You know, Sherman was on record as saying the final solution was necessary. He invented the term, as far as I can see. In Australia, it was all kept very quiet, and that's almost a quote. And it's a sort of an act of cowardice. And the Bush legend, in a way, hides this act of cowardice, this silence. Bill Stanner, the great anthropologist, who wrote one of the best books ever written in Australia, I think, 40 years ago, talked about this silence. But we buried that again. We were silent about the silence, and we've never really faced up to it. And I don't know quite why we fear it so much. And if we're going to think about the bush, if it is going to remain part of the national consciousness in any kind of serious way, well, we probably should face up to it and stop being frightened off it by really, I don't know what. That somehow our fragile character will shatter if these truths are accepted. Or that we'll dismiss the whole pioneering legend, or something will happen. The sky will fall in. The same goes, I think, for how the bush has been treated, how the physical landscape has been treated. It is some kind of thing to take an entire forest and destroy it all. All. It takes some doing. You've got to be really serious about it. And there are sort of... In our consciousness, it seems, and at least in our bushy consciousness, there are two themes. One is that there is this heroic labour that brings it about. This is the pioneering legend. And if you look at that for long enough, you realise, you know, you can make a glorious thing of the way it was done. There's an old film of two tree fellers in Gippsland perched on springboards 30 feet or more up a massive mountain ash, swinging their axes with incredible precision and timing. It's a thing of absolute beauty. The aerobic capacity is phenomenal, and I'm sure they didn't do any stretches before they got up there, and they didn't ride there on a bicycle. And they probably had a fag when they were finished. But you can look at that and realise that it's true to say that, you know, you can't get rid of a natural environment of that on that scale by merely hacking. It requires a sort of art. It's a balletic form, which is what, you know, as I said, when I closed my eyes and thought about my old man going around the hillsides, is what I thought. So that, there is that stream in our consciousness, if you like. If the bush legend, if the mainstream is that business of the heroic labour, there is a fork in the consciousness just the same, and that is regret, remorse, guilt, whatever you like. You can't destroy a forest without there being regret. I've always thought that. And I think, and the women, thank God for the women, that they were there, because we would have no record of it at all without them. We'd have, or at least the record will be about one-tenth of what it is, because it was the women who wrote down their regrets in diary after diary. And often they described the landscape, which is now gone. There's one that sticks very strongly in my mind in southwest Western Australia, where a woman, a closer settler from the turn of the century, an English woman, wrote about going out and clearing away a large hunk of Jarrah forest. But beyond the Jarrah forest, there were acres and acres of baronia. As far as the eye could see, she said, around baronia. Now, I don't know whether anyone here has ever tried to grow baronia, but I always find them rather like hens. You're likely to go out in the morning and find them dead for no particular reason. Baronia is a sort of precious, beautiful plant with a scent like nothing else. Now, if you can imagine sort of standing in a landscape completely surrounded by baronia, it's something. But she writes, of course, then she says, as they always end, but it's all gone now. And you can't help thinking, well, why didn't you leave a bit? Just a bit. But there you were, labouring away for next generations, which is, of course, what the whole bioengineering thing is about, but then not leaving a bit, taking the lot again and again and again. So, this is what, in a way, the book is struggling to do. It's trying to define both the mainstream of it, what the legend is like, but the forks in it. To give you another sort of example, the other day I read two articles in the space of about an hour and a half. One was by Jeff Kennett about depression in the bush, particularly male depression, and high suicide rates. And then farmers will get very angry about this. They'll say, you don't know how many blokes I know who've killed themselves. And every time there's a government policy they don't like, the blokes will be, they'll kill themselves because of this. And you think, what is going on here? There's no questioning it. They do. Now, there are lots of reasons for that. But one of them might lie in some sort of parallel existence anyway, with a second article by John Van Tiggelen, the journalist and editor, who wrote a piece about a strip of land up in central Victoria, not far from Maryborough, which is completely wrecked. It's like so much of the continent. It's just been destroyed. It's no good for sheep anymore. It's no good for crops. Not even olive trees will do well there. It's worn out. And it's covered now in a close relative of prickly pear, which is surely one of the most gothic tales in Australian history, that prickly pear business, for which, by the way, about 750,000 emu heads were handed in at local shire offices because people decided it was emus that were spreading it. The thought of chopping off 750,000 emu heads gets a bit grisly, and taking them in bags. When you think about the actual mechanics of that, it's quite something. Anyway, this land is covered in this cactus, and one bloke's going around trying to get rid of it all with a long spear-like thing that pumps Roundup into it. And it's obviously a losing battle, but good on him for trying. But you couldn't help thinking that there's a sort of connection between the degradation of the land and losing productivity in the land and the destruction of the land, of the landscape, and the depression of farmers who were there. Maybe not causal, but certainly parallel. Now, I don't know. I don't want to harp too much on the guilt and all this sort of stuff, but I think we do carry a fair bit of it, and I think probably farmers carry a bit of it as well. Roundup, I go on about Roundup here. It's again an example of these forks. I went to see a farmer called Michael O'Brien up near Walgett. He's got a massive spread up there, and he's an incredible farmer. He does no-till farming. The year I saw him, he was expecting to harvest $14 million worth of crops. He also runs about 5,000 Angus cattle and about 20,000 sheep. It's a nice sort of an outfit he's got going there. But then the floods came and wiped away half his crops, and the last I heard, they'd had the worst dry spell since the Second World War, so they're back, God knows where he's going now. But Michael's a ferocious, bull-like man, and obviously an enormously successful farmer who's spread his knowledge through the Walgett area, and people are doing much better than they were before. But he does it all with Roundup. It's all Monsanto farming. And you don't want to say anything against what he does, and you do want to say no-till farming is a lot better than ploughing a foot deep, but there is a problem, and we have a sort of, we have to ask whether you can go on farming this way. And so there's quite a lot about Roundup. So for every good story, I'm afraid there's probably a bad one here. But that's the way it's always been. And the funny thing is, the farmers would be first to tell you. Against that, I met two farmers in a couple in up in the Mallee. He and his wife were both 90. Marvellous chap. His father had farmed before him. They'd been on the farm since 1910, deep in the Mallee, wheat and sheep. And sitting in the middle of his wheat field in his harvester, he told me that he thought that Europeans should never have come to the Mallee. It should never have been cleared. And I was so surprised when I found this note 6 months later. I went back to him and asked him again, did you really say this? And he said, absolutely, I believe it. We should have left it. He said, but this is the food bowl. This is the legendary Mallee that was cleared for wheat and sheep. And it doesn't matter, he said. You know, the environmental cost has been too great. We've made such a terrible mess of it. So they're not all as we might think they are. In fact, the further you look, the more you find people who don't hold the views that farmers are alleged to have, mainly by hysterics like Barnaby Joyce or people like that. They're actually much more nimble and various than we give them credit for. Now, I don't know quite where to finish here. I also want to tell you that the book has a lot of things about animals in it, and you shouldn't feel that you're going to be, you know, berated about land management, because I know you'd be leaving now if you thought you were. But quite incidentally, I wanted to write about the place of snakes in Australia. I learnt in this book that brown snakes whistle when they're hunting. I don't think anyone else knew this. I'm wanting to write a short paper on it, actually. A stockman out near Mount Isa, a quite extraordinary man, and he had another stockman with him at the time, said, no one, I can't use the language he uses in this company. That was, it just came naturally to him, but he said they whistle, you always hear them whistling. And his mate said, it's true. I didn't believe it. Then my niece, who lives down on the Stony Rises in Victoria, said the worst thing about the brown snakes down in there is that you hear them whistling before you see them. And then someone just the other night from the northeast of Victoria said, of course they whistle. You can always hear them. So when you hear a whistle in future, I thought it would be the mice whistling with fear, knowing the brown snake was coming, but no. There's a lot about animals, including mice, and sheep, and cattle. There are quite phenomenal stories from all sorts of places. It is a bizarre place, and it's contained bizarre people. And I think that's probably one thing that ought to be said. I mean, Lawson, of course, said that you know, wrote about it as if it was the Gothic horror from which Gothic types emerged. You know, this was the mother bush that bore me, he said. But the harder you look at these people, it wasn't. It was Louisa who bore Henry, and that's where his problems lie, not in the bush at all. That was where it all. And the more you look at those characters who were meant to be the source of the bush legend, the more you see they were just Victorians. And all their values of practicality and pragmatism and maleness and mateship are all Victorian values. And why we've decided they're exclusively Australian, I do not know. People do have friends overseas. And generally they think being loyal to them is a good idea. But that to make a cult of it, so that it comes down to you saying, well, my mate happens to be a mug and a criminal and an idiot, but I'm going to stick by him, they don't take quite so seriously as we seem to, or we are encouraged to. So the argument really is that we brought as much to the bush as the bush brought to us. And once you start to take that view, you begin to perhaps take more seriously the sort of calamitous effects we've often had on it. At the same time, I'll just finish on this, at the same time, probably the best things that are being done in this country are being done on a lot of farms in Australia. Really terribly exciting things. And it makes you think that if we could put the same effort into regenerating the Australian landscape that we put into destroying it, we'd be on a pretty good path. It'd be quite a good national project, really, to regenerate it. And you'd find, for instance, I mean, the only thing that I think that's really worth taking, apart from all the observations that settlers very quickly made in Australia about Aboriginal land use, but the one thing we could take from them is the idea of there being part of a cosmology, of a cosmos, rather. So that you take a sort of cosmological view of the bush in which you say, well, we're just part of it. It's not here for us to crush in the way that Mao wanted to or the way that the first settlers did. We're just other species trying to survive. And once you take that view, then all sorts of things, you begin to see things much more clearly, which is when, you know, somebody like Peter Andrews and his natural sequence farming and so on suddenly has this brilliant notion. He suddenly sees that what we've done most of all is to change the way the water moves across the landscape. So if we can slow the movement of the water, then the landscape goes back to where it ought to be. And you need a lot of capital to take on that principle. Now, it would probably take about 500 years to sort of get it working, but it would be a good place to start. Now, it's on this very optimistic note that I'm ending. Thank you.
Thanks, Don. We do have time for a couple of very quick questions. If anyone has anything they'd like Don to expand further on, just put your hand up in the air and we'll come and find you. I did have one question. It sounds like your exploration of the bush has come to the conclusion that we have a very conflicted relationship with it. I was wondering what your relationship with it is after writing this book.
Very conflicted. Even more conflicted than when I started. No, it always was conflicted. I mean, I think, I won't go into the deeper conflictions, but I mean, it was a conflicted relationship. And I think, that you don't have to go very far from the sort of hard and fast myth of the bush to see that the necessary conflictions. There was to give you an example, I found this old imperial journalist called Frank Fox who went around the Australian, into the inland of New South Wales, from which the new Australian was said to be born by people like Charles Bean and Lawson and Patterson and so on. And Fox came back and said, yeah, well, they're pretty rugged out there. But he also said that because of what they go through, because of what they have to do, and he quoted examples of the most appalling, there are stories of 500,000 sheep being caught in droughts and dying in the worst possible way, or farmers having to kill 100,000 sheep. One farmer cutting the throats of 100,000 of his sheep. They're appalling scenes. And it goes on and on and on. And he said, because of this, there's a strong streak of cruelty in this new Australian, which isn't entirely true. I think it's indifference, because if you're fighting nature, you have to be as indifferent as nature is. I mean, nature isn't cruel, it doesn't have that sort of quality, but it is indifferent. So farmers get like that, and it's very hard not to be, but they're not like that. I mean, and I think an awful lot of farmers really suffer because they hate doing what they've got to do, and they get very defensive when people get upset about live sheep exports or the closing down of the northern cattle industry and all the rest, which I think should happen tomorrow, but that doesn't matter. I think there are deep psychological conflicts for anyone who thinks about it.
No other. Oh, we've got one question here.
Thanks, Don. Are we having this conversation with a view to that we believe awareness will eventually stop our activity, that it will stop us obliterating nature? Is that why we're having the conversation? Because I just think about it in terms of the conversations we have around over many, many years, obviously, around war, and the conversations around war as opposed to leading to war diminishing is actually making us better obliterators, and that worries me, you know. Like, is there a purpose in the conversation, or is it just to have the conversation?
No, I think it's a good question. And I think it's a good conversation to have. I think it's a better conversation to have than the one about the war, because it always ends up, you know, back in the hands of the cliché mongers, not to mention, you know, war mongers, if you like, but it does end up back in cliché. Whereas this has some truly concrete changes going on. I think it's a tremendously frustrating process for a great many farmers who would like to farm differently but haven't the resources, because all these changes are very expensive. And one should add, it's not only the effort that needs to go back into it, but it's the capital needs to go back into it in equal proportion. And with all the new scientific knowledge that we have, that we didn't have before. But we have to get over the business of rejecting science. You know, those mad conversations that you see between Tim Flannery and an upcountry farmer saying, you don't know a bloody thing about the bush, you're just a bloody scientist with all your book learning. You know, I mean, this has got to stop. It's insane. But an awful lot of farmers would like to change, but can't. I went out to a place near West Wyalong where a CSIRO man and the curator from the National Herbarium were running experiments about 5 years ago. And there's a wonderful picture of them. They're down on their hands and knees, and they're picking through what remains of the native grasses, trying to find them at the bottom. And all they find literally hundreds of species under these grasses, which are part of the ecology. And there are pictures of the farmers standing around looking at them with their hats pushed back on their heads. You know how they do, scratching their heads like, who are these mad buggers? And somewhere that defines the whole problem. You know, that the farmers will welcome anything that'll tell them how to fix the problem, but they need money to do it. One terrific bloke from up around there said that he thought in the end it might be that a lot of Australia's countryside is going to have to go back to the 19th century model of great pastoral companies owning it and capable farmers managing it, because they just don't have the resources to farm it properly and to do the things that people like Andrews are recommending. I mean, Gerry Harvey can own Barramal Station, a million acres, and afford the whole process, but most people can't. Just the same, if you look at what happens when you do this, as I did the other day at Bathurst, it's extraordinary. If you stop the flow of water across the landscape, suddenly things appear from nowhere. Everything from the tiniest invertebrates to wombats suddenly turn up. Not everyone would welcome the wombats, but it just changes before your eyes.
Well, if we have any other... we've got one more question at the back.
Hi, Don. Victoria is apparently the most cleared state in the country, and yet our governments are still overseeing and subsidising massive logging, particularly out East Gippsland and Tallangi in near Healesville, for things like making reflex paper. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are in relation to why some jobs, unlike, say, public servants or scientists or public school teachers, are sacrosanct, and that... And I'm talking about logging jobs.
Well, I think it's probably related to the myth that we're talking about. You know, so long as the myth endures as sort of unbreakable as it has for so long, regardless of the circumstances of this country, you know, the reality of this country, then that's going to be the case. I mean, you do want to say occasionally to farmers, look, the enclosures have been going on for 400 years. You know, people have been leaving the country for a very long while. You know, we like you, and we know it's a sainted occupation, farming. It always has been. Thomas Jefferson wrote about it as if they were the most wonderful people on earth, and maybe they are. But they also exist in a relationship with the broader society and the global economy and all the rest, and they have to make the same sorts of adjustments. So you can understand their despair. And I think it's made harder by the fact that an awful lot of them left school early, don't have other skills. And it does look like despair. They've invested so much in it and they've got nowhere else to go. But I think, you know, you can look at the silted up streams of East Gippsland and just read a little bit about what they used to be like. And then you can go and look at the timber workers, and sometimes we've got to decide to look after the streams. But don't worry about, you know, go and see what they're doing to Brigalow in Queensland, or all that Brigalow. Still, they're still clearing huge amounts of it with massive bulldozers. Maybe they're right. Maybe, you know, they might be right, but we have I would have thought, some kind of equal right to question it and see whether it ought to be being done. Maybe the way is for, you know, city consumers need to say, well, look, we want to be sure where our food's coming from. So really farmers, you know, when they get angry about the ignorance of city people about farming life, it might be city people who've got to start getting angry themselves. I don't know.
Well, if we have other questions for Don, he will be signing books at the back of the room, so save them up and ask him then. Imbigan Books are also selling copies of The Bush. Please join me in thanking Don Watson.